Mr. Speaker.
Order, order.
Nearly 7 years in the making, the Radio New Zealand Amendment Bill had its third and final reading on Wednesday night. Introduced back in June 2009, the bill contains a charter setting out Parliament's expectations of the public broadcaster in return for voting its annual funding and amounts set by the government and drawn from general taxation. Up until Wednesday night, when it was finally nodded through, with 20 minutes to spare before the adjournment at 10, the bill looked set to rival the previous endurance record of 10 years on the order paper, set by the Conservation Protection of Trout as a Non-Commercial Species Amendment Bill, introduced as a Member's Bill in 1998 and subsequently moved to the Government's order paper. Its aim was to keep trout purely for recreational fishing. After a first reading, it was sent to a select committee and reported back to languish near the bottom of the order paper until it was discharged in December 2008 after the election of the first of John Key's national-led governments. As well as being slightly quicker through the traps, the Radio New Zealand Amendment Bill actually finally did cross the line, although not without a few false starts. Back in the chamber, within 6 months of being introduced and sent to a select committee, the bill was parked for nearly 6.5 years through three parliaments and three broadcasting ministers before having its second reading in May last year. Then it began to suffer from debatus interruptus, as it was used like legislative polyfiller to eke out time in the chamber running up to the nightly adjournments. Already interrupted twice after a couple of speeches each time, debate on the third reading resumed on Tuesday night with about 5 minutes left before the adjournment and Labour's Chris Farfoy picking up where he left off over a week before.
When I was interrupted, I think it was on March the 17th, as the Radio New Zealand Amendment Bill was getting into its third reading, I was talking about the funding freeze at Radio New Zealand.
Fortuitously for Chris Farfoy, there'd been an item on Radio New Zealand's funding on that morning's Stuff website.
There was some comments by Richard Griffin, the chair of the Radio New Zealand board, and Paul Thompson, the chief executive of Radio New Zealand, which I think speak to some of the issues that we've had on this side of the house with the funding freeze at Radio New Zealand. And if I can, Mr. Speaker, I'll just read from that story. It said, Paul Thompson and Chairman Richard Griffin told this, I think it should be the Commerce Select Committee, in February that Radio New Zealand would not seek extra funding in the May 26 budget after accepting it is not a priority for more government cash. The story says they had given up on getting extra funding, but it was pointless beating your head against a brick wall, Griffin said. We have a plan, but it's not based on putting up a proposition in this budget round. We will have a plan, and the government and the Treasury are already looking at it and hopefully buy into it.
Labour's Chris Farfoy and part of that plan could involve an amendment added after the bill had been to the Commerce Select Committee, altering the definition of commercial free and allowing Radio New Zealand to sell content already broadcast without commercials to other media services and providers of delivery platforms. So something there for the watch this space space. Now for the story of another bill with an interesting background. Here's Rhys Lyon.
Introduced to the House in October last year, the Greater Christchurch Regeneration Bill came up for final reading on Thursday, after it had had a significant overhaul during its committee stage earlier in the week on Tuesday, as noted by Canterbury Earthquake Recovery Minister Gerry Brownlee when he launched the bill's third reading.
This bill before the House today was finally constructed by a cross-party arrangement where members, largely from Christchurch, sat down with the bill, looked at what the city needed and concluded or made some conclusions about the nature and shape of the legislation we need going forward. And I think the mere fact that we do have significant support for the bill in the House today indicates the ongoing commitment of Parliament to assist Christchurch.
Following Mr Brownlee, Labour's Wigram MP, Megan Woods, explained that the bill aimed to begin winding down the input of central government in the city's rebuild.
And this was always our vision, Mr Speaker, that what we have for the next phase of our regeneration would be a structure that could capture and allow for this innovation, this creativity and this energy that lay within the people of Christchurch and Canterbury to be what took us forward into the next 5.5 years and not a heavy top-down Wellington approach. So I am thankful that we do have a bill that can do that.
Labour's Megan Woods. Meanwhile, the cross-party collaboration mentioned earlier by Gerry Brownlee was explained further by his ministerial colleague and fellow Christchurch MP, Nikki Wagner, who singled out the input of three members of the National, Labour and New Zealand First parties, respectively.
The House unanimously supported the three SOPs, the supplementary order papers, that were put out in the name of Minister Brownlee, Dr. Megan Woods and Dennis O'Rourke. Mr. Brownlee's, of course, was the result of significant cross-party discussion and has added real value to the bills. Dr. Megan Woods enshrines the protection of Hagley Park, and Hagley Park, of course, is close to the hearts of all Christchurch people, so that is appreciated. And Dennis O'Rourke has added to the compensation and clarified that, so that added value too, Dennis. Thank you very much.
Nikki Wagner's sentiments were echoed by Labour's Christchurch East MP, Potter Williams, who also acknowledged work that went on behind the scenes.
By the Minister, by the Honourable Leanne Dalzell, who's here present in the gallery today, by the other members from across the House who have workshopped what was a piece of legislation that Labour couldn't support when it first came back to the House, but is now something that has support from across the House. No mean feat, Minister, and I want to acknowledge your leadership in ensuring that that has occurred.
Labour's Potter Williams. The Greater Christchurch Regeneration Bill later passed its final reading with unanimous support.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Resuming after a week's break, the first question time on Tuesday inevitably found the opposition keen to extract maximum embarrassment over the defeat of John Key's preferred silver fern flag design and the second flag referendum on the Thursday before Easter. With the Prime Minister overseas, it fell to his deputy, Bill English, also the minister in charge of the flag referendums, to be the government's fore guy, facing this opening salvo from Labour's finance spokesman, Grant Robertson.
Has he seen the report from the Prime Minister on the 6th of August last year, saying that a new flag is, quote, gonna be worth billions, end quote, to New Zealand? And if so, how has the outcome of the referendum been factored into this year's budget?
The Honourable Bill English. Order. 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 I've called the Honourable Bill English.
Mr. Speaker, yes, and of course they would have been windfall gains, so they don't have to have been factored in.
Mr. English also faced questions from opposition leader Andrew Little.
In view of the fact that polls during the course of the referendum process repeatedly showed that there was no public appetite for changing the flag, does he now think spending $26 million on flag referenda was the best use of public money?
The Honourable Bill English on behalf of the Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, no, and as the member knows, the Prime Minister is not a poll-driven fruitcake in the way that he is.
From answering questions on behalf of himself as Finance Minister and also on behalf of his Prime Minister, Mr. English was required to cover everything from the nation's economic health to safety rules for paddling pools, raised in this question on Thursday from Labour's member for Hutt South, Trevor Mellard.
Why does Housing New Zealand require tenants to seek the permission of tenancy managers before putting up a blow-up paddling pool in their backyards?
Trevor Mellard's question was addressed to Mr. English as the minister responsible for the Housing Corporation, who said that like other landlords, the corporation had to comply with the law.
And the law says that pools over, I think, 400 millimetres deep need to be dealt with properly.
Trevor Mellard then tabled a Housing Corp newsletter indicating that tenants had to get permission for pools under 400 millimetres before putting this question to Mr. English.
Does he think that on-site inspection of each blow-up paddling pool for which permission has been sought, which I am assured by the Hutt Valley Management of Housing New Zealand occurs, is the best use of Housing New Zealand staff time?
The Honourable Bill English.
Mr. Speaker, it's Housing New Zealand are in the best position to make decisions about, in the first place, compliance with the law, secondly, making sure they keep track of the updates in the law, because the pool fencing law is being changed, And thirdly, they need to conduct themselves as a responsible landlord regarding the safety of their tenants.
From Housing Corp Minister and Minister for All Seasons, Bill Inglis, and safety in the paddling pools, to the committee rooms in this report from Rhys Lyon.
Plans from the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment, or MBIE, to outsource employment mediation services between employers and employees in Palmerston North and other provincial centres were the subject of a petition presented to the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee on Thursday. It calls for a commitment to retain locally based employment dispute mediators directly employed by the Ministry. Speaking to the committee, union organiser Lawrence O'Halloran outlined the petitioner's concerns.
MBIE has talked about using contractors to replace mediators. It has said it will look for people who have the necessary knowledge, skills and attributes. Well, knowledge, skills and attributes don't cut it. Doesn't matter what knowledge, skills and attributes you have, because the key attribute is not one you can provide for yourself.
Mr. O'Halloran said that's why state servants were better suited to the role.
You're accountable to the state, you're a neutral third party, you're not answerable to an employer, you're not answerable to a union or an employee. That is the key attribute. The state needs to credential somebody and make them accountable in that way. This is the thin end of the wedge.
Lawrence O'Halloran explained what MBIE employment mediation outsourcing in provincial centres could mean in practice.
If one is in an area where one goes to mediation and your mediator is not a state servant, but is somebody who has facilitation skills or who is a lawyer who has some interest in mediation, then you are not receiving the same guarantee of impartiality and neutrality. And that object of the Act, which is to address the inherent inequality of power in the employment relationship, will be compromised. We don't want to be the ones who have to wear that in provincial New Zealand. That's why we're requesting your attention and consideration of our submission.
Union organiser Lawrence O'Halloran speaking to the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee on Thursday. Across the corridor and a day earlier, New Zealand's chief negotiator on the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, David Walker, appeared before the Māori Affairs Committee to brief them on how the TPP affects Māori. After giving a rundown of the benefits of free trade deals in general, Mr. Walker addressed the purpose of his briefing.
TPP will provide significant opportunities for Māori exporters and businesses and help grow the Māori asset base further.
Mr. Walker said the worth of that Māori asset base was estimated at more than $40 billion.
A significant amount of which is oriented towards primary sectors and our export economy, including red meat, dairy, kiwi fruit, forestry and seafood. Tariff savings under TPP, that's the tariffs that TPP governments will not be able to levy on our current exports across these sectors, estimated at more than $200 million a year. There are a number of opportunities for Māori economic interests to benefit from TPP, particularly exporters in the primary sectors.
David Walker also took the chance to explain that a Treaty of Waitangi clause in the trade deal was in line with all of New Zealand's free trade deals signed since 2001.
New Zealand's approach of including the Treaty of Waitangi exception in its FTAs is unique and reflects the constitutional significance of the Treaty of Waitangi to New Zealand. The Treaty of Waitangi exception is designed to retain flexibility for successive governments to implement domestic policies in relation to issues of importance or relevance to Māori, including in fulfilment of obligations under the Treaty of Waitangi, without being obliged to offer equivalent treatment to overseas entities.
New Zealand's chief trade negotiator on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, David Walker, speaking to the Māori Affairs Committee. And the TPP was also the subject of meetings held by the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee as it travelled to Christchurch on Thursday and Friday for public submissions on the trade deal at the city's council chambers. In total, there were 16 committee meetings held during the week.
From East Lyon there in the committee rooms and going back to the debating chamber.
Mr. Speaker.
Maureen Breen, the new Sergeant-at-Arms. She took over from Brent Smith, the face behind the mace, since 2002. Her first day on the job was Tuesday, while on Thursday, the Leader of the House, Jerry Brownie, delivered his preview of this week in the House in his business statement before the start of question time.
Mr. Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday, the 5th of April, the government will look to make progress on the Environment Canterbury Transitional Governance Arrangements Bill, the Māori Language Bill, the Electronic Monitoring of Offenders Legislation Bill, and a number of other bills on the order paper.
Not for the first time, Mr. Brownie's opposition shadow, Labour's Chris Hipkins, asked the Leader of the House if he might have forgotten something.
I wonder whether the Leader of the House can confirm that Members' Day will still be happening on Wednesday.
The Honourable Jerry Brownie.
Oh, Mr. Speaker, the government's always open to the opposition forfeiting that day to progress its own business, but that is the intention.
And this week in the House began at 2 on Tuesday with this request from Labour leader Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to move a motion without notice or debate on the nomination of the Right Honourable Helen Clark for the position of Secretary-General of the United Nations.
Leave is sought for that course of action. Is there any objection?
There is none.
Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, I move that this House express its support for the Right Honourable Helen Clark's announcement that she will stand for the UN Secretary-General role this year. Note that she has been an exceptional head of the UN Development Programme and brings her experience as a leader of a country, and that she is and always has been a trailblazer following along a long line of Kiwi women who have broken through the glass ceiling.
The question is that the motion be agreed to. Those of that opinion will say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no. The ayes have it.
Tuesday's question time was dominated by a dispute over whether or not New Zealand is a tax haven. Based on the recent leak of millions of documents, now known as the Panama Papers, opposition parties claim that the country is a tax haven. The Prime Minister says it is not. The first question of the day was for John Key, and it was from New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters.
Thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, this question is to the Prime Minister. How does he stand by all his statements?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
On foot.
Brilliant, isn't it, eh?
Order. Not sure.
The man's a wit, he's half right.
Order. We now need to get to the serious business of question time with substantially less interjection from quite a number of prominent people in the House. The Right Honourable Winston Peters, supplementary question.
How can he stand by his statements yesterday that New Zealand, and I quote him, is not a tax haven, end of quotes, and that we, and I quote him again, also have an extensive disclosure regime, end of quotes, when specialist law firms on trust for foreigners point out there is no need for disclosure of identity or trust registration or for any such trust accounts to be audited?
The Right Honourable Speaker, Prime Minister.
Because I'm right.
Order. This is now the third time I've asked for a little bit of cooperation, and I'm going to have to expect it in the future. Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Supplementary question.
Supplementary question, the Right Honourable Winston Peters.
How can he argue that he is right and that our legal requirements and obligations are both transparent and require disclosure when IRD is not required to share information with foreign jurisdictions unless that jurisdiction suspects offending and then asks them for information?
The Right Honourable Speaker, Prime Minister.
Because I'm correct and the Member's wrong.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Order. Order.
Point of order,
the Right Honourable
Mr. Speaker, I am not saying that I'm right. I'm asking
order.
Him a simple question which doesn't require that flippant answer twice.
Order. No, the question started with how can he argue that he's right? And the Prime Minister gave an answer that satisfied that. Member might not agree with it, but that's addressed the
question.
Supplementary question, the Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Does he agree with John Christensen, Executive Director of the Tax Justice Network, that, and I quote them, trusts are used in many instances as one of the basic building blocks of these sophisticated tax evasion structures, end of quotes? If not, why not?
The Right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm here to be a trust expert, but people use trusts for all sorts of reasons. They use them because they want to have their assets held because they may, for instance, be sued, or they may use trusts for all sorts of other reasons. Members of this House use them all the time.
Supplementary question.
Supplementary question, the Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Quoting from this long statement from the Prime Minister, quotes, tax havens are where there is non-disclosure of information. New Zealand has full disclosure of information, so all you've got is a situation where New Zealand has taken a different view from a lot of jurisdictions, and that's because the way we tax is we tax a set law. In other words, it's all about making sure that New Zealanders...
Order.
Pay their fair share of tax, under quotes.
I do need a supplementary question, not a long quote.
Right. Well, to conclude, in other words, it's all about making sure that New Zealanders pay their fair share of tax, unquotes. What on earth does that mumbo-jumbo really mean?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, well, it sounded a lot better when I said it. But, Mr Speaker, the answer was that we tax a set law, and the reason we tax set laws is because it's good tax policy, because it stops New Zealanders actually creating taxes in all sorts of foreign jurisdictions and avoiding paying tax in their home country called New Zealand.
Supplementary question.
Supplementary question, the Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Well, then, if he is right, why are so many international commentators and now the Australians having a go at us for being, in their words, a tax haven?
Right. The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Well, as the member knows, people throw around all sorts of comments, but New Zealand is not a tax haven.
Supplementary question.
Supplementary question, Right Honourable Winston
Peters. Can he assure this House that none of his present or former ministers... That's him as Prime Minister, have been and are involved in tax haven activity.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, I can't speak for any other member because we have a pecuniary interest list that people have to record. But as I've recorded on my pecuniary interest, I have two trusts. One of them has been the long-established trust I've had in my wife's name, the JP and BIK Family Trust, and the other is the Allgate Trust, which is established so it could be a blind trust that when I became Prime Minister, all of my assets could go in there.
Supplementary question.
Order.
Blind
right
trust.
Honourable Winston Peters.
Is that blind trust one with 2020 vision?
Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, I have no ministerial responsibility there other than to say that a blind trust was established as other Prime Ministers have because it's good practice to do so.
Supplementary question.
Supplementary question, Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Why, since he's become the Prime Minister, has there been a threefold increase in offshore trusts operating in New Zealand, were it not for the discovery internationally of just how lax our tax money laundering disclosure regime is?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, that's not true. Tax laws around trusts were established in New Zealand in 1988. The disclosure regime changed, was implemented in 2006. Subsequent to that, there's been a number of other things that have been done to improve aspects of trust. In 2013, the OECD gave a report on New Zealand and fully cleared New Zealand.
Mr Key then faced questions on the same subject from opposition leader Andrew Little.
My question is to the Prime Minister. Does he stand by his statement that New Zealand is not a tax haven because, quotes, New Zealand has full disclosure of information, end quotes, given Cohn Marshall, a law firm specialising in establishing trusts for foreigners, say, quotes, the identity of the set law need not be disclosed and the trust deed is not registered with any tax or government authority, end quotes, and, open quotes, there is no obligation to file any trust accounts with any person or institution or to have such accounts audited, end quotes.
And as I call the Right Honourable Prime Minister, my office has been advised this answer may well be longer than normal. The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, yes, because there is more than one step in the disclosure process. Initially, a New Zealand resident trustee must submit the Foreign Trust Disclosure Form, an IR 607, which simply records the name of the trust and the trustee's contact details. However, the trustee must also keep detailed financial and other records, including the trust deed, details of settlements and distributions, including the recipient's name and address, details of the trust's assets and liabilities, the identity of the settlors and the beneficiaries of the trust, and money that the trust receives and spends. Inland Revenue can get this kind of information and will give it to the tax authorities in any other country if requested under a relevant tax agreement or proactively if that country wishes. I'm advised by Inland Revenue that New Zealand has always been able to comply with these sorts of information requests from treaty partners. This is certainly full disclosure of information. Mr. Speaker, the income in these trusts is quite rightly outside our tax base. It is foreign income earned by foreigners. It is up to other tax authorities around the world to enforce their own tax laws on this income and on their own residents. We can help them do that by providing detailed information to them on requests about trusts that are administered from New Zealand. Mr. Speaker, I make the second point, which is we automatically disclose that information to Australia. They're one jurisdiction that has asked us. No other jurisdiction has. These disclosure regimes, which by any definition are broad and deep, were the ones passed by the Labor government in 2006.
That's right. Supplementary.
Order. Blame someone else.
Order. Order. Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Is he seriously telling the House that the only obligation that a foreign trust is obliged to follow or to make, which is completion of an IR 706 form and nothing else, constitutes a full disclosure regime for this type of vehicle?
Mr. Speaker,
right honourable Prime Minister.
For a start, if it's a 607 form, not a 706 form. And secondly, Mr. Speaker, as I pointed out in the answer, which was very long and very detailed, that is but the starting point, which requires them to keep a hugely detailed information what's in there and report that when required. They were the rules that Labor thought were right when they passed this disclosure in 2006. If the member's now telling us that Labor got it wrong, get on his feet and apologise.
Order.
Order.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Why has he failed to heed the warnings from the New Zealand Law Commission, the Chartered Accountants Australia and New Zealand, the OECD and IRD, that New Zealand's weak offshore tax laws allow wealthy foreigners to subvert laws and dodge taxes?
The right
honourable
Prime Minister. Well,
Mr. Speaker, I'm prepared to accept that I made one mistake, and that's relying on Labor. They passed the rules.
Supplementary.
Did you vote for them?
Order.
Did you vote
for them? Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Can he guarantee no offshore trusts registered in New Zealand are being used to hide illegally obtained assets or dodge tax?
The right honourable Prime Minister.
No Prime Minister could give that assurance any more than Helen Clark could have when this law was passed, no doubt with the support of David Parker, in 2006. But Mr. Speaker, what is quite clear is New Zealand gives all of that information not only to Australia but any jurisdiction that asks for that. And we've been able to comply with every jurisdiction that's asked. Now, I'd also note that we have 40 double tax agreements and 11 information sharing agreements, one of which includes Malta.
Supplementary.
Were you warned 3 years ago?
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
What effect does he think it has on New Zealand's reputation when we are viewed as a tax haven harbouring billions of dollars and his only reaction is to boast that it earns us $24 million a year in lawyers' fees and accountants' fees?
The right honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, New Zealand is not a tax haven. Tax havens don't have the disclosure regimes that New Zealand have. But, Mr. Speaker, it's as simple as this. If it's such a bad idea, it was Labor in 1988 who passed the trust legislation. It was Labor in 2006 that had the disclosure.
Order.
And if it
Order.
Was a great idea Order. To close...
Order. The Prime Minister, when I rise to my feet, it requires the Prime Minister to cease his answer.
Final word there from the Speaker, David Carter. I'm Tom Frewen, and this program was made with funding from Parliament.